Their graves are inscribed with Arabic and tended by their Aboriginal descendants. It's just one part of a relationship between Aborigines and Islam that is historic, complex, and becoming more important in today's Australia. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and on The Spirit of Things, we'll be exploring that relationship from several perspectives, including a personal one, with Ramiz, who recently became a Muslim. You're on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Ramiz, with this decision to become a Muslim, what has your extended family, your siblings, how have they reacted to your choice?
There hasn't been a problem. Look, I think, my father's not with us anymore, but I think my mother's very happy because of the discipline, and she's had to, you know, a mother's heart breaks when they see their sons go astray, you know, as any mother. So I think she's very happy that it's put me on the right path, you know. So as far as my sister goes, I'm assuming she's happy. I can't speak for her, so I don't know. And extended family, my kids I think they're very happy. The ones that have seen the other, which are the older ones, you know, they don't think it's strange or weird or anything. They just totally accept it. Like, they ask to come to mosque, you know, on a Friday. If I'm about there, they'll actually, can we come to Jummah? The little fellas, they want to go anywhere with Dad, you know, so they don't even, you know, they just run up and down between the everyone praying, you know, so, but that's no good. But, yeah, that's just part of it. No, it's no drama. They, no problems.
Shortly, we'll be hearing more about Ramiz's journey to Islam. And later, Dr. Peter Stevenson of the University of Melbourne tells me about the growing phenomenon of Indigenous Australians becoming Muslim. Her research, which took her around the country conducting interviews, resulted in a book, Islam Dreaming. It's a fascinating insight into the social and spiritual motives that have brought Indigenous Australians into the international Islamic community, the Ummah. But first, Ramiz, who is Aboriginal with Afghan heritage, agreed to talk to me about what brought him into the arms of Islam. Ramiz, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Ramiz, you've been a practicing Muslim for over 2 years. Does that mean you've gone through the witnessing process, the formal witnessing process?
The Shahada, yeah. Yeah, I said the Shahada in front of a couple of witnesses. So
what is
that? If that's what you mean by the formal process, yeah. It's just, وَشَدُّ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ وَشَدُّ أَنْ مُحَمَّدٌ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ. I bear witness that there is only one God and that Muhammad is his messenger.
Well, I know that your ancestry actually is both Indigenous and Afghan. What do you know about your grandparents? How did they meet?
Well, I know my grandfather was from the Afghan-Pakistan border. I don't think it was called Pakistan then, because I think that was prior to the annexation, when the colonies were made up of Bangladesh and before India split, you know. So I'm assuming it was either called India or Pakistan or Afghanistan then. So, but he jumped ship in Queensland. I think he's an illegal immigrant, and he cut cane in Queensland for many years before making it down to the Queensland border, where he took my grandmother off the mission. Well, basically, she had no rights. She wasn't even human, basically, under all the protection laws. Aboriginal people were still classified as flora and fauna then. So basically, it was her way out to marry this older man.
How much older?
Well, I'm assuming he was quite a bit older, because he had a family already established over there. From what I know, I'm a bit sketchy. I don't know the whole history, but I'm assuming, I think he would have been in his 40s already, or late 30s, early 40s.
And that, and she was what, a young girl?
She's about 13 or 14.
Wow. I guess that union would have been prevented by the authorities at that time. Did they have to run away to get married?
I'm pretty sure they ran away, yeah. And they, from the stories I've been told, they ran around on a horse and sulky and sold goods, like a lot of the Kashmiris and that did. Following that time, that I found out through Peter Stevenson's book, that, yeah, they just sold wares and stuff. And then he actually became a halal butcher. and used to bury the men from the subcontinent that come out here on the big ships. If they, one of them died on the way over here or died, you know, unloading goods and stuff, he became the imam to give the rites and stuff like that.
So he was an imam. He cared for those who needed halal food and also who needed to be buried according to Islamic practice.
Yeah, a mullah, I think they call it over there, an imam.
Well, how much did your grandmother take on of her older husband's religion?
Well, she basically converted, or reverted, they like to refer to it today.
Explain that.
Well, conversion and reversion. Well, I think Muslims believe that everyone's born a Muslim. Everyone's born pure. That you only develop, well, I think with males, it's when you're about 14 years of age before you can actually commit a sin. So you actually revert to Islam. You don't convert.
That's interesting. So does that mean your Aboriginal ancestors are all actually born as Muslims?
Yep.
But they just haven't reverted?
Well, according to the Quran, 144,000 prophets were sent to the world. Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the last. So in that time of whatever you want to refer to it as the dream time or pre-invasion, we were sent some of those prophets. We were shown the laws according to what we required then. So if they weren't set out as Islamic laws, such as, you know, the five pillars, they were the laws that were needed for survival, to survive throughout those times and practice those laws. So whatever they referred to him as by Ami, like the Gadigal mob did around here, or whatever name they had for him, he was the one God.
Who were your grandmother's people?
She was from the Millerai Nation, northwestern New South Wales.
And they eventually came and settled in western New South Wales?
In western Sydney.
In western Sydney?
Yeah, yeah. As far as I know, that he had a shop there, and like a lot of immigrants, they were skillless, basically, I think. You know, probably his only skill was being an imam and being able to recite the Quran. And I don't think there were many Muslims in Sydney then. And so there was no probably requirement for an imam. Who needs someone who can recite the Quran and advise on spiritual matters when there's no one interested, you know? So I think they had a shop and they sold like groceries and things like that.
Well, it sounds like he was a devout Muslim. What about his children?
Well, my father never practiced. I think the thing with my dad was that the grandfather took him out of school at a young age to go and do all this business with him. And I think he had a bit of resentment towards that. And I think he was finding it hard to fit in already because he was the only black kid in that school to begin with. So I think the resentments must have crept into him. I can't say for sure because I'm not him, but I can imagine that he would have turned on it because of that, because of being forced and trying to fit in. That's hard to fit in anywhere, no matter who you are, you know.
Fitting in as an Aboriginal person as well as a Muslim?
As well as, and having a funny name, you know, as well. and being an Aborigine and having that funny name and being in that white school as well. And I'm thinking at that age, you know, like, I'll just see my sons and how difficult that age is.
Indeed.
And I think back to when I was, and it's a hard time for any kid.
Well, how were you raised? Were you raised with a particular religion?
No, there was nothing forced on me. It was just, my father used to say, repeat the words of my grandfather that he said to him, as long as you believe in something, I'm happy with that. As long as you believe in something, that maybe he's referring to not being an atheist or a kuffar or whatever, you know. It's,
What about your mother?
Mum, I think she was raised Anglican, which means what? You know, I don't know what that means.
So you weren't obviously shown that tradition, raised in it.
Is there a tradition? Like, it means like you turn up on Sunday, doesn't it? And
I think Anglicans would quibble with you on that. They certainly do have a tradition and beliefs, but it was not obviously part of your experience.
But it was always, like, religion and politics, everything, all those things were discussed, you know, quite regularly, but there was never anything forced or anything, you know, this is the way.
Mm.
So
when you were growing up in Sydney, how did you identify? Were you open about being Aboriginal and being a person with a Muslim background, or how did you identify?
Well, I grew up as a black fella, you know, so I'm mixed with black people. So it never entered my mind until someone pointed it out to me in the playground one day, or in primary school, and it come to fists, you know.
They pointed out that you were a black fella?
Well, that, they pointed out I had a funny name, whatever, you know, they'd find anything. Primary school's like a microcosm of society, but people actually say what they think. especially if they've heard their parents say it, you know, it's, I had a lot of fisticuffs at school.
Yeah, sort of thing. So pretty tough, pretty difficult.
Oh, you can, other people have had it worse.
Well, you're tough. You had a long association with Rastafarianism,
yeah,
which is a really interesting, newer religious movement that believes in Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, as a reincarnation of Jesus Christ, and uses marijuana as a sacred weed, and is pretty Afrocentric, obviously, pretty anti-Western in a lot of its rhetoric. Were all those things appealing to you?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think it was very appealing as an angry young sort of black man for someone to be telling me God is black. You know, when you've grown up seeing the pictures of the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus, peace be upon him, and the whole clergy, the guy, the Pope, up in the big robes, you know, looked up to, and then you hear someone telling you, that's all wrong, here's the truth. I find, you know, and to hear the Rastas say they couldn't find his body. You know, they're telling us that Jah's dead, Jah not dead, and he was here, and he come for us. And I think also the smoking of the dope, that appealed a lot to me because, you know, they could show you a passage in the Bible where it said, you know, the smoke of thine herb and become red in thine eyes, you know, to become dreadful and fearful. So it appealed a lot to me at that stage of my life.
Why didn't you go into the arms of Aboriginal spirituality, which in your time was becoming more popular? A lot of academics were writing about it. It was, indigenous religions were becoming really popular.
Probably because I didn't trust what white academics had to say. I feel they were looking at it from an anthropological perspective, and I feel they'd still do it today. You know, you can, going back to the Rastas, Bob Marley said, who feels it knows it. You know, so I don't think anyone can fully explain that religion or that spirituality today because it's been so fractured and fragmented. As soon as they got off the boat, they started destroying it. They stopped people speaking the languages. And once you lose that language, it's the first connection you lose.
Did you have any connection to your grandparents' people, your grandmother's people?
Yeah, off and on. But see, I grew up in a different town and place to that, and it was a different time.
So you were pretty remote then from your actual Aboriginal ancestors,
yeah,
and relatives.
Yep, yep.
Well, you were in Rastafarianism, 10 years? It's a long time.
Yeah.
How did it shape your attitudes, your outlook?
Well, I think it is actually one of the things that led me to Islam as well, because one of the main, I suppose, what would you call him? The main founders of, like, the philosophy of Rastafarianism was Marcus Garvey. And when I picked up a copy of Malcolm X, his autobiography, he referred a lot to Marcus Mosiah Garvey. And Malcolm X's father was actually a Garveyite, Baptist preacher, but he was a Garveyite. And so we all know the story about what happened to Malcolm X's father, how the Klan, because he was a Baptist, he was a preacher around the southern states of America, the Klan, and because he was advocating Garveyism, of return to Africa, separation of blacks and whites, because it's, you know, basically we're not going to get along if they're doing that to us. And we're not going to keep turning the cheek, which is what Malcolm used to say as well. And they basically got Malcolm's father, tied him to the railroad tracks one night, and you're going to guess what happens from there.
So you were really fired up about black and white relations, and reading Malcolm X's autobiography, of course, would have then connected you to his own embracing of Islam.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't until quite a few years later that I actually did embrace it, so...
How did you do that? I mean, was it just hanging around other Muslims, having Muslims as friends?
Well, there was that, you know, and living in the western suburbs, I encountered quite a lot of people of the Muslim faith, you know, and there was one particular brother I used to spend a lot of time with, who'd African-American, who'd reverted, you know, who grew up in a similar way to me, a white mother, black father. Yeah, there was probably that connection as well. But it was only after some really tough times that I actually fully accepted Islam, you know.
Does it require something of a crisis to make you want to reach out to a religious faith in a really full-on way?
Oh, I can only speak personally, but it was... I had to hit rock bottom before I could call out and ask for help.
Why did you think Islam would be able to provide that?
It's basically because I made a covenant that... One day I made a covenant with Allah that I said, if you can help me now, this is the end for me. the stage I was at. If you could help me now, I'll make a pact with you now. You know, that I'll follow this way.
Can I ask you what it was that brought you right down?
Well, I'd gone really downhill. I'd been living on the streets. I was drug and alcohol addicted. I was basically a rock bottom, and I was there for quite some time, and I just had enough of it, and I was going to go on a big bender and big binge and just like finish it all. And I called out one day, and I was answered straight away. Basically, I got the call to go to detox and spent a couple of weeks in there. It's been a couple of months in rehab, and since then I've followed the faith.
Ramiz is my guest on today's Spirit of Things, where we're exploring Indigenous Australians becoming Muslim. Later, we'll hear from Dr. Peter Stevenson, who's documented the phenomenon in her book, Islam Dreaming. I'm Rachel Kahn, and before I return to my conversation with Ramiz, this is the music he would have heard a lot before becoming Muslim, from the Rastaman himself, Bob Marley, a speech by Emperor Haile Selassie he set to music. It's called War.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation.
Well, I suppose Islam also being against alcohol, yep, against intoxicants,
yep,
would have been tailor-made for you.
Exactly.
But Islam has also fueled a lot of violence recently. Of course, the World Trade Center bombing, the London bombing, Madrid bombing, Bali bombing, intercepted bombings just this last week. How did you make sense of that? Did those events ever give you pause about reaching out to a faith that had been connected with this kind of violence?
Well, if you want to go back to September 11, 2001, I was living in a park and I saw it as flashes walking by, I think places like David Jones or whatever, that had got the TVs in the window, and I was just like, whoa, not affecting me. But by the time the London bombings had hit, it was 2005. I was still, you know, so it didn't affect me personally. I think that I didn't connect with it because of it felt distant. It was like that's over there. That's over there. Here are we in Australia. We're still, Aboriginal people are still the lowest common denominator by every social indicator, you know. So what's this got to do with me? I still see things through that prism, that perspective as an Aborigine.
Aboriginal Australians are a really tiny community worldwide. Now you are a member of one of the largest religions in the world, over a billion, that is international. Does that mean something to you? Is it important to you?
To be honest, it's the first, when I reverted to Islam, it's the first time I felt like a human being in my life. First time I felt like a man. I wasn't this bit or that bit, or quarter this, octoroon, quadroon, you know, half white, half black, whatever. I was actually a full human being, and Islam gave me that. Bilal is revered in Islam, one of the Sahaba, one of the first African revert to Islam. He had a dream about the call to prayer that we sing every day, five times a day, the Adhan, is from his dream. They adopted that, you know, and he's revered in Islam, Bilal. It made me a man, because true Islam, not this thing you see on programs like Insight, true Islam is the connection between you and Allah. It's not about what some supposed extremist has done. And we could probably talk for hours about who created all that, what, you know, who funded those people to be that organisation that committed those horrendous acts on innocent people, you know, and why. Are we ever going to get the answer? the only one who has the answer is Allah. And those people are going to face that day when they get the book in the right hand and the book in the left hand, and they have to explain themselves.
What branch of Islam do you belong to? Because there are different sects, different streams. Sunni, Shiite, Sufi.
Well, if you want to put a label, I suppose I'd say I'm a Sunni, because I practice the Sunnah.
And the Sunnah are the collection of hadith that describe Muhammad's life, how he practiced.
Yeah.
So you have the Quran, the Sunnah, and Sharia law.
Yeah.
That's a pretty disciplined lifestyle. Very different from, say, I imagine...
Living in a park, drunk all the time. I suppose it's what I require, you know, because if you want to talk about it scientifically, I'm not one of those people who can actually drink, have a social drink. I'm not one of those people who can have a social smoke or take some social drugs, you want to call it that, because I just can't stop at one. Like, I'm one of those people who have to drink the whole bar, basically, you know what I mean, before, and then move on to the next one, you know. So the discipline is something that, has helped me, you know, return to a life where I can be of value to my children. I can be a valuable member to my community. I can be a good neighbour. I can be a good husband. I can be a good father.
And does your wife adopt the Islamic practices that you've undertaken?
She said the Shahada, but she doesn't, like, wear hijab or anything like that, or practice or pray five times a day or anything like that. But she's basically accepted Islam. Mm.
How about your kids? How do they feel about it?
Oh, when I pray, they'll all run in behind and pray, the daughters especially. The eldest sons, they're not. The second one, he'll fall in, and, you know, when he feels like it. But you can't make someone do anything they don't want to.
Well, that is one of the principles of Islam, isn't it? Not to make someone follow, just to sort of leave them there.
You can make da'wah and, you know, talk about it, but it's not about preaching. You're not supposed to proselytize.
Are you comfortable about being open with your faith, though, say in work situations or otherwise?
Not really.
Why is
that? I think it's more of a personal thing for me. Like I said, it's between me and Allah. And on the day, that's when it matters, you know.
But how easy is it to keep it under wraps if you have to pray five times a day?
Well, it can be done, you know. It's not I don't feel like I'm being sneaky or anything, because it's not, you know. If there are obligations put upon us, and it says in the Quran, Allah does not want to make it difficult for you, you know. There's certain things you can make up prayers later if you miss one. He doesn't want to make it difficult.
You said earlier that you feel like a man for the first time, like a human being, not a part this, a part that, part black, whatever. Then how do you relate to other Aboriginal Australians who, like you, may be part white, part black, and who still see themselves as very much Aboriginals, Indigenous Australians, connected to the faith of their fathers?
Still my brothers and sisters. That's where my heart is. I was born on this land, you know. It's still got a connection to that country, this country. The probably difficulty is, it's like you've got Bangladeshi Muslims, they've got their own community. You've got Lebanese Muslims, they've got their own community. You have African Muslims, Sudanese Muslims, Eritrean Muslims. They've all got their own little communities. We don't have one yet. And I think when we finally do, that there will be a different time.
Do you think it's going to be a popular choice amongst Aboriginal Australians to become Muslim?
Inshallah, that's all I can say, you know. It's up to the individual, and he leads those who he will to the path, you know. I just hope, inshallah, that people don't have to go through the same thing I had to get to that point. But in the hadith of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he also said that, you know, he'll lead you to the quickest path for you. That's loosely paraphrasing. And I must have come, that must be the quickest path possible for me that I was led on. So hopefully that they don't have to go through the same trials and tribulations that I did to find that point.
But certainly a lot of Aboriginal Australians are going through trials and tribulations, particularly through alcoholism and all of the social consequences and health consequences of that. Do you think that's going to be one of the reasons why Islam might be popular?
I can't really say. It's... Inshallah, you know, it's There is a lot of those communities I've been to. It's a very sad and depressing state of affairs. But not only, you don't even have to go to the bush to see, you can go to Mount Druitt or Redfern to see what social problems you're referring to. And like I said, it's about us that are Muslim being the best of the Muslims, being just by our actions. That's the only way we can, it's the only way the Prophet, peace be upon him, said that you can get people to Islam is by your actions. And that is how he got people to Islam, is by his actions of being well-mannered, being kind, being gentle, you know, being an upstanding person. You know, it's smiling when you meet someone. You know, it's not hard. It's just, you know, trying to be cool and calm all the time. It's sad that we've got all these perceptions of Islam created by a rabid media hungry for sound bites and pictures, you know. It's sad that not only Muslims, but Aborigines too. And then you get, when you do come to Islam and try and come into that Islamic community, there's Muslims there with perceptions of Aborigines, of drunks, child abusers, all that sort of thing. Even though that they feel demonized by the media, they have that perception of you and your people as well. So there's a difficulty there also.
Do you feel in any way that you've abandoned your Aboriginal heritage?
No, because that is your nationality is something created by those powers that run this world, the colonialists. The invaders created that. The people that when Cook and Phillip invaded, they created that. We were just people. Aboriginal people were just people prior to that.
But they had their own set of beliefs. They had their own myths and creation myths.
Yep.
Do you try to see parallels at all between Aboriginal beliefs and Muslim beliefs?
I think there are many parallels. You can't live somewhere and survive somewhere for over, 60,000 years, that's the latest estimate. I think it's actually even longer, without having some kind of law to live by, you know? And I really think that the closest people to creation were Aboriginal people. They were as close as you can be to creation, and hence the closest you can be to your creator, you know? And if you want to say it Islamically, that the 144,000 prophets, going back to that, of course we had prophets. And like I said, the laws according to the times that they were acquired. You know, Muhammad's just the last line in those prophets, peace be upon him. You know, that's the final word. You know, like in Judaism, Ibrahim, okay, and Musa, Moses. You can follow all the prophets down the lines to Muhammad, but he was the last one. So that's the final word. I think Aboriginal people worship one creator. There was a creator. They might have had the rainbow serpent or whatever, but, you know, and spoke about how the animals were created and those sort of things. But also you've got to remember that those things have been watered down. There is not, in this part of the country anyway, there's no one that is that connected to be able to tell those stories anymore, not that I know of, from its original source. And the only original source we have to refer to now is the one from the last prophet, peace be upon him. And that is the Holy Quran, which hasn't changed from the words that was written since the 23 years he received it.
We opened this conversation with you saying a prayer in Arabic. Do you actually read the Quran in Arabic? Have you had to learn Arabic?
I've learned bits. It's very difficult because of all the other distractions in life. It's essential, I think, to be able to not only read Arabic, but write it and comprehend it. Because, like the Aboriginal spirituality, it's been chopped down. You can't take a whole word, you can't take a whole concept or a word from another language and translate it to English without losing something, you know. It's like any language, it's like, you know, same like Hebrew to English, you know. It's without losing some of the context. And if those words were given in Arabic to the Prophet, peace be upon him, I think there's parts in the Quran that says, I've given you this in Arabic. Because prophets were sent to all nations. And going to that, I think you have to learn Arabic to be able to fully understand you can't recite it in English. You can't stand up there and say, in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. You have to say, get up there and say, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. You can't, you know, it just doesn't convey the same message. But inshallah, I'll continue to learn.
Ramiz, do you have someone you look up to who has been a great influence in your life?
Oh, obviously the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And Malcolm X, Al-Hajj Malik Al-Shabazz, Malcolm X. Yeah, great inspiration.
Well, I think you're going to be an inspiration to many Aboriginal Australians. Ramiz, thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things.
You're welcome. Jazakallah khair.
That was my guest, who went under the name Ramiz for this interview. I'm Rachel Khan, and you're tuned to Radio National, where you can download the audio to listen anytime you like. That's at abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things. Coming up, the woman who's documented Indigenous Australians who've become Muslim. Malcolm X was the black American whose life and conversion to Islam has been an inspiration to many Indigenous Australians.
There's nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery.
Malcolm X, through his autobiography, has his Aboriginal followers, as we've just heard in Ramiz. But the radical side of Malcolm X isn't the only story to be told. Peter Stevenson, who's a research fellow at the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne, just published the result of a research project that took her around Australia, interviewing Indigenous Australians who've become Muslim or have had Muslim ancestry. Her book, Islam Dreaming, is full of first-hand accounts, along with historical, social, and political analysis. It's as thorough a book as you'll find on Indigenous Muslims today, and I was keen to speak to her. Peter Stevenson, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thanks, Rachel.
Well, Peter, the accepted term for Muslim Aborigines is reverts rather than converts. How many Aborigines that you spoke to believe the Islamic explanation that they were all born Muslim and they're now only waking up to it and reverting?
Yes, many of the Indigenous Muslims I spoke to used the term revert rather than convert. It's one that Muslims use generally, but it appealed to Indigenous people who embraced Islam because they felt a strong urge to sort of go back to a former identity in one way. They wanted to get in touch with their pre-colonial Indigenous roots. So the idea of returning or going back appealed to them. And Muslims say that even if you convert at a later age, you're just going back or reverting to your original and true nature as a creation of Allah. So I think while Muslims in general like that idea, it had a particular appeal for Indigenous Muslims.
Do you think it softens the blow a bit? Some Aborigines regard their choice as a sellout. So do you think it softens the blow that they might be abandoning their Aboriginal heritage to say that they're actually reverting?
No, I understand that there are Aboriginal people, yeah, who have an issue with the idea of being both Indigenous and Muslim at the same time. But the Indigenous people I spoke to, I don't think they embrace that term reversion to soften the blow of taking on that mixed identity. It was more that they saw real cultural parallels between their traditional Indigenous ways and the cultural practices that occur in Islamic communities. So things like arranged marriages are common in both. Husbands are usually much older than their wives. Men can have more than one wife, male circumcision. So when they started to read about Islam, they found so many similarities that was another way for going back.
Yes, and I suppose the segregation or the separation of the sexes would also be something that would be parallel to some extent.
That's right. A number of interviewees mentioned that, you know, traditionally men and women had separate spheres of influence, you know, secret women's business, secret men's business. And of course, that's very similar in Islam. Women have a very particular role and men have a separate and particular role.
How many of the informants that you spoke to explained their reversion to Islam as a way of dealing with problems that they were experiencing, or indeed as a protest against their experience of Christian missions.
I think for some indigenous people, their interest in Islam first came about because they felt dissatisfied with the models of community offered up, you know, in the broader Australian community. They felt angry at the colonial legacy, the breakup of families. Some of the men in particular spoke very clearly about being what they called angry black men. But Islam helped them, rather than defining themselves against white Australian norms, they could be part of a whole other community that had a different set of cultural practices and traditions.
Well, we've just heard from Ramiz, whom you interviewed as well. And for him, becoming Muslim was in some ways a lifesaver, especially choosing a way of life without alcohol.
Yes, absolutely. Alcohol, drugs, gambling, all of those things are proscribed in Islam. So particularly for people who have grown up in communities where the traditional structures are broken down, the elders no longer have a say, the family is perhaps broken apart for various reasons. Young men in particular who are struggling with finding role models in their lives and needing some structure and guidelines. And Islam has, you know, some quite strict rules, some do's and don'ts, and following a faith that says avoid alcohol, drugs and violence, the things that often lead to incarceration, has been very emancipatory for many men in particular.
Yes, and some of the informants whom you interviewed also spoke of the importance of cleanliness and punctuality as Muslims. Were they seen as distinct advantages over the Aboriginal culture they came from?
Yes, I mean, it's ironic that some people perceive the idea of an Aboriginal Muslim as a threat, but they've actually become people who are perfect role models, and they've taken on many of the values that are in accordance with white Australian ones. For example, as you said, cleanliness, punctuality, having a job, contributing to society. There's an emphasis on Muslims to be the best person they possibly can and to contribute to the communities and societies within which they live. So from being marginalised and perhaps at risk, young men have found a model that gives them some pride and confidence, and with that they're also engaging much more fully in the community.
But in some ways, those values could also be at variance with contemporary Australian practice. For example, the importance for women to be obedient to their men. Now, I can see that that would be quite different from, say, how a modern Aboriginal Australian might want to see their relationship to a man, to a partner.
Yeah, I didn't find any men, or women for that matter, that subscribed to that notion that a Muslim woman must be subservient to a man. In Islam, men are the head of the household, but they don't make decisions without consulting their wives. I mean, it's very hard to generalise about this. You may find communities and families in which men have the final say and women are marginalised, but among the people I spoke to, the men took great solace from the fact that they had a role in the family, and the women also enjoyed the fact that men were there as their protectors. Many Indigenous people have come from families where the men are absent to embrace a faith which says the men are there to protect you. You can see why they're attracted to that.
And there were also some women who protested a bit about the controlling nature of the man in a Muslim marriage. It seemed that women wanted to kind of loosen some of the strictures in their marriages.
Yes, I mean, and I think, you know, you can easily find that in non-Muslim households as well. But definitely the women I interviewed had been born and brought up in Australia. More often than not, they married men who had migrated here from Muslim countries, who perhaps had different cultural expectations of women. So there were definitely cases where women sort of came up against male patriarchy. Now, whether or not you want to see that as Islamic is another issue, but they sometimes felt that the men had to understand that they were women who were brought up in a different way and saw themselves as equal. So becoming Muslim for Aboriginal women hasn't always been easy. It hasn't, you know, liberated them from every frustration they've felt.
Well, just how many Aboriginal Muslims are there in Australia?
Yeah, as you can imagine, it's very hard to get a precise figure. I went to the Australian Bureau of Statistics and found that in the last three censuses, which are taken every 5 years, in the first 10-year period, the figure was about 600 or so. But in the most recent census, which was in 2006, the number climbed by 60% to more than 1,000. So still not talking about large numbers of people, but that is a significant climb in the most recent period. And I'd be interested to see what happens next year in 2011.
I think you interviewed, around 50 different Aboriginal Muslims?
Yes, from all around the country.
Yes. What was the breadth of your interviewees?
Oh, I wanted to show in the book the broadest possible spectrum of Indigenous identification with Islam over time. So I interviewed people who haven't converted or reverted to Islam in a formal sense, but who might have been brought up in a Muslim household. There have been many early waves of Muslim migration to Australia, including the so-called Malay men who came to the top end to work in the pearl shelling industry, and to the Afghan cameleers who traversed the desert country through the centre. And they had long-term relationships or marriages with Aboriginal women in each of those places. The children of those intermarriages don't classify themselves as practicing Muslims, but they're very proud of that Muslim heritage. And they certainly grew up seeing their fathers at prayer, learning how to kill meat in halal fashion, never eating pork and those sorts of things.
And can I ask you, how many women and men did you interview? What was the spread there?
Almost half. With the converts, there were slightly more men than women, and that is the case in the statistics as well. I was calling those people who grew up in Muslim households but who are not practicing Muslims kinverts, with a K rather than converts, for a couple of reasons. Kin, of course, is very important to Aboriginal people, the kinship and familial relationships. But also, the people I spoke to, they had no label or way of defining that connection to Islam. And I've noticed that a couple of so-called kinverts have been using that term themselves. So I hope it does both represent their connection to Islam, but differentiate it from that of a convert.
It's interesting, you mentioned that the connection to their aboriginality wasn't necessarily religious. It was often ethnic or racial, a recognition that they had Afghan or Malay backgrounds. So does that mean that when traveling imams come to hold a service among them, the reaction is somewhat tentative?
Yes, I didn't find, there were a couple of cases in which people had grown up in Muslim households not really understanding the theological aspects. They were perhaps cultural Muslims. And some of those did convert and become practicing Muslims later in life, but the vast majority weren't actually that interested in learning about the doctrines or the tenets of Islam. They were just happy to have had that family connection, and they certainly weren't going out and buying copies of the Quran and learning about the faith in any deeper way.
This is The Spirit of Things on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. You can hear this program online by going to the website. My guest is Dr. Peta Stevenson of the University of Melbourne, and she's the author of Islam Dreaming. You mention in your book that almost all of the Aboriginal girls who became wives of Afghan or Malay Muslims were of mixed race and lived on missions, and so they would have had a Christian influence first. Why do you think that was the case? Why do you think Afghans or Malays chose them?
Oh, I don't know if it was so much that they actively sought women who had been mission-raised. It might well have been more the case that by the time these men were arriving, which was, from the 1860s onwards, many of the women and girls they came into contact with had been removed from their families and had grown up on missions, particularly with the Malays. They came to Australia from the 1860s to the 1960s. So it's just logical that they would have been in contact with women who had been raised on missions and who were in Broome, for example, were very strong Catholics.
So you don't think there was, a preference for lighter skin Aborigines with a Christian background, that Muslims were recognizing that, for example, they would be people of the book?
Yeah, there might have been an element of that. There's evidence that those who came from an Afghani background had a preference for fairer skin in their countries of origin. So perhaps they were more attracted to Aboriginal women of mixed heritage, and they might have been attracted to mission-raised Aboriginal girls and women because they had some religious upbringing already. And as you say, Muslims believe that Christians and Jews are people of the book. That is, they follow an Abrahamic faith. But it's very difficult to determine how much those factors came into play or whether it was, you know, chance and circumstance.
Mm. Peter, after reading your book, my impression is overwhelmingly that Islam is adopted by Aborigines, but Aboriginal spirituality is not readily adopted by Muslims, that it's largely a one-way movement of cultural assimilation. Is that the case?
Yes, I would think that's correct. And in fact, you know, a lot of Aboriginal people I spoke to said they felt that the migrant Muslim population in Australia perhaps needed to understand Aboriginal culture more fully, should take on some of the social justice issues surrounding Indigenous politics in Australia, and to understand that Muslim migrants had a relationship not only with the broader Australian community, but with the Indigenous one as well.
Peter, I guess the big question that many would be asking is, why become Muslim when there's quite a bit of negative publicity around Islam as a result of terrorist bombing, etc.? Mm. Are we seeing a new kind of politicization of a community that in the past has not been particularly politically strong?
Well, I think Islam is among the fastest growing religions in the world. So in some senses, Aboriginal people, their growing identification with it might merely be a reflection of that growing global interest. But I think your point is well taken. A lot of the young men in particular did have an interest in Islam because they saw it as a sort of political identity or a way to further their interests as Indigenous people. But over time, as they've engaged more fully with the Quran and the teachings of Islam, that has gone by the wayside and they've become much more attracted to the spiritual side of Islam, and it's ceased to be something that they've done merely as a sort of oppositional, sort of anti-white gesture.
There's been some concern, even among some Muslims, that the radicalization of Aborigines in jail, for example, could be taking place. How much did you discover that?
Well, I didn't visit the prisons because you can't take recording devices with you into jails. But I did interview three Muslim prison chaplains who have had dealings with Aboriginal prisoners over a number of years. And they felt that there were some young men who became interested, particularly through Malcolm X's autobiography. And they revered him as a figure of the Black Power struggle. More often than not, in reading his text, discovered that Islam completely changed Malcolm's life, helped him deal with the anger and the hatred he had towards white Americans, and helped him find another path. More often than not, the Aboriginal Muslim men follow a very similar trajectory. They start out with that anger, and then they realise that Islam gives them another route. But of course, there will be some, you know, I can't rule out that there might be some young Aboriginal men who are attracted to Islam for, you know, the wrong reasons. But as I say, I didn't interview anyone who made statements along those lines to me. More often than not, I found evidence of people who might have started out with an interest in Islam for that reason, but who over time became, you know, role models.
In your interviews with Aboriginal Australians, did you get a sense of what branch of Islam they were following? Was it important that they belonged to Sunni or Sufi or Shiite?
Not really. I did ask that question, and some people did proffer, oh, I'm Sunni or I'm interested in Sufism, but more often than not, there was a refusal to engage with those different dimensions of Islam. They spoke very much about the pure Islam and just following the Quran and the Sunnah, or the practices of the Prophet. They felt that they were political factions and they were interested much more in the pure message of Islam.
So in the end, Peter, do you think that this is really a journey toward belonging in a community of Aboriginal Australians who themselves feel fragmented?
Yes, absolutely. I think Islam has a particular appeal for those people who don't feel a sense of belonging in Australian society, and suddenly they're part of not only a strong local Muslim community, but also a global one as well, the Ummah. So even if they don't have, they never meet an international Muslim, there is still that sense that they're part of a growing international community.
So do you have a sense that there might become a unique Aboriginal Muslim community or way of life here that becomes quite distinct?
Yes, I think a number of the people I spoke to are trying very hard to connect with other Aboriginal Muslims and to organise along those lines, because they do have a unique experience of, you know, being Australian, of being Aboriginal, and of being Muslim. And it doesn't mean at all that they don't have things in common with non-Aboriginal Muslims, but the book, I think, has played a small part in connecting people who have felt really excited by the prospect that there are other people out there like them and new conversations are emerging.
Well, Peter, I'm sure of it. It's certainly a fascinating book and an important story on the Australian scene, Islam Dreaming. Thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Peter Stevenson is an honorary fellow at the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne, and her book, Islam Dreaming, has some wonderful photos, and you can see a couple of them on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And while you're there, you can download the program or add your comment about anything you heard on today's program.
Yeah, that's right. This cut goes out to all y'all. That's permission. That's for man. Yeah.
Production today was by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Jenny Parsonage and Manny Wasserstrom.
It might sound a little something, but damn the game. If it don't mean nothing, what is game? Who got game? Where's the game? And like, behind the game, behind the game. I got game. She got game. We got game. They got game. He got game. It might feel good.
Next week, from idealism to activism, Andrew Harvey once taught religious studies at Oxford University and decided that the road to spiritual transformation was paved with stones, not yellowed pages in dusty tomes. I'm Rachel Kahn. Join me next week on The Spirit of Things to find out whether you could be a spiritual activist.
There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware. Time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Hey, yo, I don't think they heard you, Stevie.
Ramiz, do you expect to go on the Hajj anytime soon?
I would love to, inshallah, if there's anyone out there willing to chip in some money. I'd be going. It's on at the moment. I think it was last week, Hajj, to do the Arafat and all that. It was last week. I don't know if your brothers were over there. Inshallah, of course, it's one of the five things you're supposed to do. So,
after which you would be called a haji.
Inshallah.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life,